So welcome, everybody. We are going to study math for a little while, and then we're going to do some complex policy and more math. So if you, they say the more you learn, it makes your brain active, and it stems off anything where you start forgetting things more than you remember them. And so Mr. Greenman is never going to forget anything with the kind of math dances he has to do. Welcome to the committee.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Greenman. I'm the budget director at the Department of Human Services, and I was asked to come in today and provide a short summary of the November 2018 forecast. Hopefully you have in your packet this document, which is called November 2018 Forecast Changes in a Nutshell. So I'll be working off of this document to sort of go through the numbers. And what I'll probably do, since this is going to be brief, just to sort of hit the highlights as I go through these. The big story with the...
Well, Mr. Green, we have a little bit of time, so this is actually an important topic. We are the finance committee of this topic, so we're interested in every number you could think of telling us. So, I mean, you don't have to belabor something, but...
Yeah. Yes,
yeah, give us the full nut there, if you will.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So... The story of the November 2018 forecast really is reduced spending relative to in the November forecast relative to the February 2018 forecast. As you can see from the top of from the first page, the general fund total change in spending from the February forecast to the November forecast for 2018-19 was savings of $214 million, and in 2021 was a savings of about $521 million. So over the 4 years, it's total savings or total reduction in expenditures of about $735 million over the four-year period. I'll start out with looking at long-term care changes. That's on the first page, it's sort of near the top, where it talks about MA long-term care facilities, alternative care, and MA long-term care waivers. There are relatively minor changes across both facilities and waivers in this forecast. There's about a 0.1% reduction in spending or a change in this biennium and about a 2.8% increase in the next biennium. There's three main factors that come into play here. One is the nursing facility average payment increase was 3.6% over the next biennium. This is under the value-based reimbursement system for nursing homes. Operating rates were about 2% higher than what had been projected or what was expected for calendar years 20 to 23 increases. So we adjusted those up by about 2%. For an ongoing annual rate increases of about 6.5% to 7% per year for nursing facilities. And there you see that about a $39 million increase in calendar years 20 or fiscal years 20 and 21. And then for long-term care waivers, the biggest change here is that this is almost half of the change for the for the long-term care area. PCA services are no longer provided through PMAP. They're now through managed care plans as of calendar year 19, so they're now being provided through a fee-for-service system. And so there's an increase in expenditures in the waiver programs for the PCA services of about $67 million in 20 and 21. That is offset in reductions in the basic care area because we're moving those services off of managed care and putting them on fee-for-service. And then the last change is for DD recipients. We're assuming a recipient increase of about 3% in the next biennium. And this adjustment's we expected a period of increased growth after the legislature took the caps off of the DD waivers 3 years ago. What's happened is the increase in enrollment that we expected to see has gone on longer than we expected. So there's an increase in spending on the DD waivers and that's about $42-43 million. So the total increase in spending, well, for the waivers program, the total increase in spending is about $116.5 million in 2021.
Mr. Greenman, should we do questions just as we go? Maybe that's, especially if they're kind of short. So, Senator Hoffman, go ahead.
Real short. So, are you going to address, you know, a couple of years ago we passed a bill, became law, that said 3% reserve for waivered people on the waiting list. And are you going to address that? There's $93,743,787. I'm looking at a report you guys sent out, page 17. It says 6%. So are you going to address that 3% difference, or the fact that there's now, there's money that's still sitting there that's in part of our reserve that we should be utilizing for people with disabilities? Is that going to be part of your presentation?
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, I don't believe that's part of the forecast, so I won't be covering that.
But we can take that up maybe at the end a little bit. So, yeah, just keep going. Okay. Thanks. Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Greenman. Just can we go back a little bit to the PCA change? There was an increase that was going for fee for service. And then I wasn't following, but that there's a corollary decrease in the capitation rate that we give for that. Or explain, I think I know exactly what you're saying, but I just want to make sure I understand what the offset was to the taking it out of managed care, putting it in the fee, or out of PMAP, putting in the fee for service, and then thus I would assume there's an adjustment in what we were giving the PMAP program for those services.
Mr. Greenman.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, starting in calendar year 19, PCA services are no longer going to be provided and paid for under the cap rates in managed care plans. So those are going to, they've been carved out, they use that term, and they're now available as a fee-for-service program. And so that moves those services out of the basic care area and reduces basic care costs. And it what it does is it ends up increasing costs in the waiver program, the waiver programs and the, the waiver programs, home and community-based services.
Okay. Just keep going. Thanks.
So the next area then is basic care, and the story with basic care is basically a lot of reductions. Basic care average costs are down because actual expenditures, the average costs for basic care are down because actual expenditures were less than anticipated trend in than the trend for managed care rates, which brings down projected rates into the future. And so we're seeing rates that are lower than we had projected them to be in the managed care area. So we're seeing reductions. For example, you see under the elderly and disabled basic care a savings of about $85 million. That's actually, that has to do both with the lower number, fewer recipients, and the lower rates. The same with the disabled basic care. You see a reduction of about $74 million. That's due both to lower enrollment and also to lower average costs in those programs. Enrollment is down in our basic care programs as well, in particular for adults without kids and for families with children. This is largely due to the strong economy, and you'll see that throughout the forecast that for a lot of our forecasted programs, we're seeing a reduction in enrollment. And so that's, you can see that adults without kids spending is reduced by about $41.5 million. In 2021, and then for families with children, it's actually a reduction of $208 million in basic care for families with kids. As you can see, the average cost is 1 to 3% lower for that population, so that's $96 million in savings. And you can see the below that, you see a $65 million savings. That's where you're seeing the savings to managed care plans from carving out the PCA services.
Senator Benson, I just had a question for you, too. Are we going to do this in your committee at all, or is this where the place to ask questions would be?
We can ask questions here. We were going to wait till the new forecast comes out and
okay,
do a similar walkthrough.
So go ahead, calling on you.
So I did have a question. I want to, under MA Adults with No Children and MA Families with Children Basic, PDM delay, Mr. Greenman, is that what I think it is? And why is it still going on in 2021?
Want to get away, Mr. Greenman? Go ahead. Or you can answer the question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, the periodic data matching is delayed. It had the anticipation was that it would start, I believe it was in April of 18. It was delayed. It started now. The first month of enrollment effects are going to be in March. So we're seeing some small residual costs due to the delayed enrollment, But we are in the process of enrolling it out.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Greenman, though, why is there still a cost in 2021 when it should be smoothed out and should be reflecting sort of ongoing status quo that should have been built in, but we're seeing some charges here. I'm wondering what that residual effect is.
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, that's a really good question, and I don't have the answer to it. I think what I can do is follow up and get back to you on that.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I look forward to the follow-up.
Okay. Mr. Greenman, on the so I think we'll just maybe take questions on this page, and we'll flip it over and do questions there if anybody has questions about this side. But I see you're noticing that that there was less expenses in some of the maybe capitated programs. Do we account for that? If they spend less, do you get some money back? If they underspend what we've given them, is there like a guaranteed only like 1% or something anymore of profit?
Mr. Chair, what this reflects, the reduction in the managed care rates or the average cost rates is the reduced rates that we're paying for managed care. It's not necessarily what the managed care plans are spending themselves. It's what we're actually paying them on a month-to-month basis for capitation. So I'm not...
Okay.
Yeah.
And so do we know how much money they actually expend on behalf of patients? Is there a report back to us that tells us that they spent 94 cents on the dollar or 89 cents on the dollar or something like that, that they tell us?
Mr. Chair, I believe there's limitations on what they can spend on things that aren't necessarily just for patient care. I mean, I believe that there's a cap on admin expenses. I'm not sure what exactly that is, but there is a cap on it. So that does limit their ability to spend anything. What we're paying them, there are limitations on their ability to spend that money on things other than patient care.
Right, and beyond, this is the wrong committee for these questions, really, but I'm interested later if somebody could tell me what their loss ratio is in practicality and how much do they can't spend, but can they keep it, and those kinds of questions. So I'll just leave that as an open-ended thing for people who are listening somewhere else, Mr. Morocco or somebody. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Greenman, I really think that Senator Abler's question really hits at the heart of something that's very important just in terms of credibility. And I would ask either you or perhaps Senator Benson if you would weigh in on this. But unless we have a breakdown of dollars spent and then how many of those dollars are going towards care and what the medical loss ratio is, it's really hard for us to compare it to other ways of doing things. And if we're going to try to be innovative and try to get our dollars to go further, I just feel like this information is critical, and I don't know when we're going to get the specific information that I'm hoping that we get, but I think, Senator Abler, you're asking exactly the right question. And if we don't get this information, we just won't be able to make our dollars go further.
And, Senator Jensen, it's my experience that when we ask a question like this, a memo pops up And we'll address that question. So now that two of us have asked, maybe it'd just be one memo, but anyway, it's going to have two names on it. So,
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Please.
I think Senator Benson would like to comment.
Well, there's three names on the memo. Senator Benson.
If it's going to get me a memo, yeah, I will comment. I was actually looking, I was trying to solve the problem as we're sitting here. MDH, if I recall correctly, has a report that that we use for the basis of the managed care audits. And I cannot for the life of me remember. It's like an A1 or an A1E report, but it breaks out administrative percentages. It probably isn't exactly what you're looking for, but it's on the path to what you're looking for. So I was trying to find it, but if Mr. Greenman has a better idea, I'd be happy to be on his memo. So.
Senator Klein wants to be on the memo too.
Mr. Chair, absolutely want to be on the memo. It sounds like it will be important information. However, I just want to caution that the way we interpret it when it arrives, let's say we find out that a certain organization is only spending $80 on patients for the $100 on contract that they got on that, and that's considered a failure. Why aren't you spending $90? Well, no, the whole point is to incentivize them to lower their costs, and so a lower number in some ways would be a sign of success. So. In any case, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, Mr. Chair, but when we get those numbers, I wouldn't consider a low outlay of funds to be a failure. So.
Thank Mr. you. Chair.
Senator Jensen.
To the point.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Klein, I don't disagree with you, but I think if we see the number of dollars being spent and then we see how much of that is being spent on the medical loss ratio, and then if we see what kind of reimbursement rates are going to the people providing the care, I think that's where we start to get to that magic spot where we can say, okay, listen, there's some stuff we can do here. Because I think one of the concerns is, what's the access availability for some of these folks? And part of the reason is because a lot of clinics are saying, I'm not going to be involved, not at that rate. So I think there's a certain amount of skepticism and suspicion that we're not necessarily aware of how much reimbursement is really going to the people providing the cares. And I'm not just talking about physicians. I'm talking about PCs. I'm talking about just even durable medical equipment.
Fair enough. Anybody else want to weigh in on what the memo might say? Anyway, thanks. Senator Hoffman, what memo?
You might as well add that memo, Senator, Mr. Chair, that you're hitting on it, because there's also an issue of workforce shortage that comes into play on that. Those people that are providing the services and supports to the people that are most needed, you know, there's 9,000 positions open just in the 7-county metro area. So add that into the memo as long as you're adding stuff about what we should be doing. So
you got the memo about the memo, Mr. Greenman. Thank you. Let's turn the page over. Senator Hayden, you get the last question on page
one. Mr. Greenman, do you think you can put all that information in the memo? It sounds facetious, but it's super serious because, to Jim's point, we've been waiting on this for a long time, trying to figure out that very thing. And so, with all due respect to my colleague, Senator Klein, that it does, you do have to break that out, because money goes in and then money goes out, and then we kind of depend on people to interpret it. And forever, we're hearing about Medicaid reimbursement rates, and we're hearing about providers, and way before I got here, and trying to figure out how to get more money to the providers so that they don't, somehow they don't get it, and it gets locked in a lockbox, and only special people get to see it, and we talk about it every year, and you look at me just like you're looking at it now, and we still come up with the same question. So I guess the real question is, are we going to be able to get the data so that we can actually get at the issues of how do we spend our money and be able to articulate that to all of the folks that are concerned about this, that they're getting the most that they can?
So, Senator Hayden, I think I'm going to treat that as a rhetorical question and then be very happy to have helped my good colleague have more work to do in her committee, because I think that'd be the place to take up the discussion when the smoking memo does actually arrive. So, anyway, so we're now on page 2, Mr. Greenman. Thank you for that, and you're welcome for not making you answer that. Oh, actually, I'm sorry, we have to go back to page 1. My favorite topic, min choices, seems to have had some cost increases, and I didn't know till lately that that's forecasted. Do you know anything about that?
Yes.
Why it might be higher?
Mr. Chair, we did see a base increase in min choices expenditures in this forecast. relative to the February forecast. We saw continued growth from what we'd seen in February, but in one sort of piece of good news is we'd been seeing increases in MnChoice's expenditures over time. What we're seeing now, the good news is that for the last three quarters, MnChoice's spending has been pretty much been flat. So we're hoping that it's plateaued at this point. But yes, there has been there was an increase from the February forecast.
Yeah. Oh, and can you tell me why it's positioned under basic care? Is that just where you stuck it, or Mr. Greenman?
Mr. Chair, that's pretty much where we put it for the purposes of the forecast.
Okay, has to be somewhere. And so I'm just, for people who are paying attention to these questions we have, I have no more questions today about this, but, you know, I'm a big fan of assessments, but I want to try to put some money into the care side. So we'll discuss this some more, and I understand this is paid with the random time moment study, which I think is just crazy. So it doesn't reward innovation. So anyway, so that's just another rhetorical sentence. So Mr. Greenman, go to page 2, please.
So moving on to the Chemical Dependency Fund, you see significant savings in the current biennium and a smaller savings in the out years. What you're seeing there is we're seeing higher federal revenue coming in for those services. This is basically because we're seeing more services being provided through the Indian Health Services. I believe back in 2016, there were 35 Indian Health Services providing SUD services. Since then, the number of those clinics has gone up by 20, and so we're seeing a lot more services provided through the Indian Health Services. They're 100% federally funded, so you're seeing state expenditures going down as a result of that. The other issue with the Chemical Dependency Fund is we have what's called the delay in the settle up there. You see a savings in 18 and 19 and an expenditure increase in 20 and 21. And what's happening there is we have institutions for mental disease, they call them IMDs. There are certain types of facilities that are not eligible for MA expenditures. For a number of years, we had been billing the feds for a federal match on those facilities. When we weren't supposed to, we've caught that, and we've stopped doing that. But we assumed that there was going to be a settle up eventually for the previous expenditures that we've made, or the previous federal match that we've received. And so we assumed that would happen in 18 and 19, and that didn't happen, and that's why there's a savings in 18 and 19. We assume the settle up is going to happen in 20 and 21, which is why there's additional expenditures.
Got it.
Due to the settle up. Most of the rest of the way down in terms of the MFIP program, child care assistance, the story really is the economy. The enrollment numbers are down. Caseloads are down due to the economy. So you see MFIP reduction, general fund spending on MFIP reduced by about $47 million in 2021. And child care assistance by about $20 million in 2021 as well. We are seeing a reduction in the North Star program as well, and that spending reduction is due to children moving from legacy programs to the North Star program more slowly than we had anticipated. And since the North Star program is more expensive, we're seeing a reduced cost because of that occurring. Moving a little further down the healthcare access fund, you see very small changes to Minnesota Care. MA funding has gone up by about $119 million. In 2021 from the Healthcare Access Fund. That's because of a technical issue that happened with a forecast adjustment that should have been made in, or that was made in the 2018 legislation. that passed but was vetoed by the governor, so the forecast was never adjusted, and so it's still showing high general fund expenditures for, or high healthcare access fund expenditures for MA, higher than would normally be needed. And so because the forecast was never adjusted, that those expenditures are showing up in the forecast.
So, Mr. Greenman, so that's not really money we're going to spend. So the the real money available on 2021 and 2223, $118 million to the good then? If it's just a paper adjustment?
Mr. Chair, right now in the forecast, what it's showing is the legislature appropriates money every 2 years from the Healthcare Access Fund to fund part of the medical assistance program. And the legislature has typically set that amount based on what they think they're going to need to pay for the program at that time. The forecast for the program showed a declining need for healthcare access fund spending for the MA program last year, and the legislature attempted to adjust that forecast spending amount, but it didn't happen. So currently there is still healthcare access fund money, additional healthcare access fund money going to spend on the MA program in fiscal year 2021.
That we don't need. Right. So the healthcare access fund should be higher than if all the money was just where it should go, there'd be money in the healthcare access fund and the general fund would be a little lower. No, I said, okay. I bet this will be made sense of in the governor's budget when it'll be cleaned up. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. I don't know.
Thank you. Yeah, that was funny. Okay. Keep going.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, for not paying attention, but I did actually find the report. It's at MDH. It's called the Supplemental 1A. It actually has a pound sign in front of
it. Thank you, very good.
So I will send it to you. I sent it to Senator Jensen. Anyone else who wants it, let me know.
Senator Benson, does that answer all the questions that we asked? Okay, so just to the department, you're not off the hook. You can reference that magic, the magic report to the smoking memo. Mr. Greenman, if you want to finish up page 2.
Mr. Chair, that's all I've got.
Okay. And then there's you get advice that we'd like a comment about the shutdown impact on human services? Or is that something you can, just tell us what you can tell us. I realize it's all kind of hypothetical, but there was a press conference yesterday, and at least that information was helpful, I think, to me.
Mr. Chair, what I can tell you, or what I know, is really the most immediate impact from the shutdown is to our SNAP, the federal SNAP program, which provides food benefits for about 400,000 Minnesotans a month. We had been under the, up until the end of last week, had been under the impression that once the January benefits ran out, there would be no more SNAP funding. However, we learned that the federal government, through a rule that they have in place on the federal level, were able to provide February benefits for SNAP participants early. So what's happened is we've had to work with our county and tribal partners to process cases and get the program up and running to get the benefits out by January 20th. We're actually a few days before January 20th, so we make sure the benefits get out in time and for the February benefit set. And so we've been working on that. The total cost of the SNAP benefits per month is about $42 to $44 million. And so the federal government provided funding for that. So there will be SNAP benefits. However, they'll be coming early to people. And so there's a little bit of a concern that that people will really we want to make sure people are aware that that they're getting their February benefits early so they don't overspend, or so they're at least aware that these benefits they're getting now are meant to last them through the month of February.
So. And so if nothing, let's say things, a month drags on and we're just where we are now in Washington, will March's SNAP benefits be paid by them early or anytime?
Mr. Chair, we have no indication from the federal government that they'll be able to do that.
Okay, this is just kind of a lucky stroke that it worked out, sort of. And then could you also comment to that? Yeah, go ahead, Senator Hayden.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Greenman, how much do we spend every month for SNAP benefits?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, I believe the cost is about $43 million a month.
So if nothing else happens, sorry, Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Chair, Ms. Greenman, so if for some reason things do drag on in Washington and March benefits are due and the state decides to step in, it would be $43 million that we would have to expend without understanding if we'll get that reimbursed or not, because we don't know. But that would be the dollar amount we'd be looking at.
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, yes, that's correct. I think that's aside from the challenges of how you actually provide that benefit to people. Right now, it's provided through their EBT card. It's a food benefit they get through their EBT card. What the federal government will do is turn off the food portion of the EBT card, and so we would need to see if we could get either the federal government to not turn off the food portion of the EBT card, so we could populate that with funds to pay for the food portion, or find some other way to get the benefit to people. So that sets up some challenges there as well.
And Mr. that would require legislative action to do that. The governor or nobody could do that on their own, right? To Mr. appropriate $43 million for March would require us to do something. Senator Dean.
So then with Ms. Chair, Ms. Greenman, then that would, so if we didn't have the EBT card, we'd have to find another way, but also ensure that people are using it for its intended purpose, which is kind of one of the fail-safes that the EBT card gives us, right? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Greenman, just one last question regarding the child care assistance program. I remember sitting in a room down the hall several months ago when we talked about the issues of oversight, and Senator Klein, you had made a comment at that time that you wanted to make certain that the narrative wasn't jaded, if you will, and that was the oversight adequate. And I think, you know, we had an audit done. But within the budget that you have here, is there, how much of your budget is devoted to internal auditing, internal monitoring, so that indeed the oversight would be adequate? I was just curious about, you have 19.9 and 15.3. Could you just help me understand that a little bit? Because I have a fair amount of constituents that say, you know, we understand that there's grave concern, and they just want to know how do you know that going forward we're where we want to be?
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jensen, the numbers you pointed out, the 15.3 and the 19.9, that's actually the reduced expenditures for the actual child care assistance payments that we make. That doesn't include, that's not part of the same area of the budget that funds the audits and the investigators. That area is in the Office of Inspector General. Carolyn Hamm leads that up for the department. I can tell you that I'm not, probably not the right person to tell you whether to comment on you know, how much funding we provide. I don't know exactly how much that is. I do know we have investigators. I know we do audits. And I know we have programs that pay for investigators out in the counties to do program integrity programs.
Does that help, Senator Jensen? We'll be discussing this more. This is going to come up more. We have a whole Senate File 4 is devoted to integrity and fraud and whatnot. So.
Because I know, Senator Klein, you've been concerned, too, about the oversight. You know, and are we where we want to be? That's, you know, I remember you saying that.
And Senator Jensen and others, the OLA has a report coming out. So we're trying to cluster things if they make sense. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is the you talked a little bit about the SNAP program and some of the, because of the federal government shutdown. Does that also affect the other streams like Ability One federal dollars or the prenatal, home visiting, perinatal, any of the Title V EPSDT dollars that come in, or is that all pretty much, is it's not going to affect? Because then I also would want to know if people are into some type of determination whether they qualify for benefits because of a related condition or disability. Does that also, is that going to affect people in Minnesota because of the fact that there is a government shutdown?
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, I'm not aware of those programs being affected or those services being affected. I'm probably not the best person to answer that question, though. But I'm not aware of those services being affected. One of the reasons why SNAP is affected is because it's funded through the Department of Agriculture, and that's one of the some number. Many federal agencies, I believe, are funded through the end of federal fiscal year 19, including the Department of Health and Human Services. So most of those programs are funded. The Department of Agriculture, which runs the SNAP program, which runs, I believe, it runs WIC as well, is not funded, and that's why the SNAP program is affected.
So as a follow-up, Mr. Chair, so when you say the fiscal year, that's comforting to know. I mean, it's not comforting that we have a government shutdown and here we sit having this discussion, but is it the federal fiscal year, the October 30th, or is it June 30th as the fiscal year? Do you know how you're looking at that calendar?
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, it's the federal fiscal year, so it's September 30th.
And I appreciate this. We're going to wrap up this segment, but if you could inquire if some of your folks could just give us another memo with a different heading. This would go to me, just with a kind of a listing what things might be at risk at some point if if things drag on a year, what happens? You know, I mean, let's just do within the fiscal year the things that are paid for through September, just so we can just have an idea because it's and we'll. Hopefully not talk about this much because I'll get it figured out. Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Greenman. I wanted to just go over the TANF numbers really quickly. I just want to make sure I'm tracking them. And maybe I should just ask questions instead of going through it because you get it. Is there an anticipated surplus in TANF now that it looks like the usage is down due to the economy?
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, I believe the way the TANF funding works is it is direct appropriated by the legislature, and I believe that it's a fairly complicated way in which TANF funds work, but the dollars are generally always spent to the extent that funding. What you're seeing is reductions in general fund expenditures for these programs, not necessarily TANF spending. And so, the TANF fund balance, which we prepare every 2 years, always generally shows a small amount of surplus, but that those dollars are always spent down. To pay for the program, and usually that offsets general fund spending.
So is that good for now?
Yeah, that's good. You know where I'm going. Well, Mr. Chair, you know where I start to go with this. But
yeah.
Well, thank you, Mr. Greenman. We'll just have an offline conversation. Great.
So is there a TANF fund balance, like a surplus? That's another question. Well, somebody said there's $100 million sitting out there or something. Is that true, or there's some large number?
Mr. Chair, no, there's not. There is a balance of some amount, but
it's not that.
We project to spend it down to zero.
Oh, because someone thought we could increase the monthly, the 437 higher based upon that, but that's not exactly true. Okay. Senator Hayden, go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair, Ms. Greenman, I want to be clear, the legislature will propose to spend it down by saying there's a surplus, we should spend it on something. Like, I mean, I just want to be really plain language. If there's a balance, we often sit around the table and say there's a balance. Here's something that we'd like to spend the balance on, and then we'd start to spend that down if it looks like there's a reduction some over time. So visiting nurses, think that there's a bigger need for visiting families. We could increase that, and that would start to chip away at the I mean, because you articulated that we even if there is a surplus, we often figure out a way to spend that money down.
We're good at that.
Right. I just want to make sure that that's what he's saying.
Mr. Chair, it's spent down in the forecast, so it's automatically going to be spent down to zero on current services. One thing I would suggest, and I'm not trying to not answer your question, but I'm wondering if it would make sense for us to sit down with you and just kind of walk through the TANF fund balance, because I think it's pretty complicated, and it's a little hard to explain in this kind of a setting.
Okay, so the last thing, there is a scenario, Mr. Chair, Ms. Greenman, there is a scenario that in the forecast we could see a surplus and reduce the general fund spending in that to accommodate what the surplus could look like. Is that a scenario that could work?
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, I'd have to go back and look at it. I'm not sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think that's a great idea to talk about it later somewhere. So thanks, Senator Hayden. All right, so thank you for that. And let's do Senator Utke's bill and bring his testifiers down. And I want to point out while he's coming, there's this amazing form of the – this is out for the public. This is like the most interesting form. It's 10 years or so of spending general fund and all funds. And it shows the growth. And if you understand this chart, you would do well on this committee. But we spent a lot of money, and we provide a lot of good things. And so we'll be discussing some of these things later. But it's interesting to look at the percentage increases, especially in the out biennium, how much that goes up by 12.6%. And we didn't even buy anything for that time yet. So Senator Utke, welcome to the committee. And here's my plan. And just to announce future scheduling, we have caucuses every day after each of our 2 days at 4:45. And so for the people who want to go home on time, I have good news for you almost every time. That might be an evening meeting sometime after a caucus, but just to take away all the fun. But mostly we'll try to get done on time and not have to come back. We don't like evening meetings, and a lot of people have kids to worry about and everything. So we're going to be quitting right at 4:30, and so we're going to run this thing till about 4:22, and then we'll take up the last bill of the day. So, Senator Utke, and just to remind the testifiers, we've been through this topic quite a bit, and your unique comments that you can offer about your situations and whatever, that's really helpful. So Senator Utke, go ahead and do your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And because of the way this bill is going, are we going to move the bill to start with?
Oh, you can move it. It's going to stay
here. I would move Senate file number 6.
It's not going anywhere. And then it's going to be held here, so you'll move it, and we'll talk about it, and then we'll lay it over.
But then I'd like to offer the A2 amendment, because that's what's going to bring the bill into the condition we want to talk about today.
Okay, and this is the first committee, and we want to talk about the differences. So Senator Utke moves the A2 amendment. Does everybody understand that? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. It's adopted. The bill's like you like it, so you're ready to go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A2 was a delete all amendment, so that's the bill in its entirety as we're seeing it. And I don't know if anybody studied the original bill that came out, and I give you a couple quick updates. Page 1 on the amendment, it was just to better define the predominant classification codes for the direct care staff. And then in Section 4, which was on page 12, it was just some clarity was added. Dates used earlier in the bill were used to describe a paragraph K, and then further under K, additional clarity is added, adding by NEO and commissioner, so that rather than assumed, it is now stated. And additionally, under the effective date for Section 4 instruction to lead agencies when the initial competitive workforce factor must be implemented. And then I'd like to do just a quick walkthrough, and then I'm going to turn it over to our testifiers to dig in a little deeper.
And Senator, actually, just for the big picture, is this a 7%?
Yes.
Just give me the big picture first. This is 7% starting July 1st of this coming year.
Well,
so, like, tell me that. Tell me the biggest overview, and then we'll go to your details.
Yeah, I was just going to say this bill is what we've been hearing about as a 7% bill ever since early last year in 2018. So this is the bill coming forward to address that. And I'll jump right into, you know, in Section 4 is where we're going to address the numbers of it. And this is actually an 8.35% base wage index factor. So it's coming in to replace that 7%. And it does two things. It deals with the percentage, and then also it deals with the inflation factor starting in July 1st of 2022, and every 2 years thereafter, the commissioner shall adjust the competitive workforce factor using the data. And rather than a five-year plan as it's currently set up, it's bringing it into the two-year renewal or relooking. Those are the quick numbers. I can then turn it over, and we can get some additional testimony. And of who wants to start first? We're going to go this way here. Okay.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Schmutzer. I am the executive director for a nonprofit organization called FAZE. We serve about 500 Minnesotans with disabilities in day employment and transportation services in East Central Minnesota. We are also part of MORE and the Best Life Alliance. This session, the Best Life Alliance's 2019 legislative proposal includes those essential updates to the DWRS, or Disability Waiver Rate System, like the inclusion of a competitive workforce factor included in Senate File 6. At FAZE, this reform in Senate File 6 is fundamental to the continued support for East Central Minnesotans with disabilities. Not long ago, one of our DSPs, our direct support professionals, Michelle, approached me and said she was leaving a job in a company she loved at FAZE to go work in a similar position for the state. Excuse me. Michelle is one of those people that exhibited the exact qualities you would want in somebody supporting your loved one with a disability. When I asked her why, she said money and benefits. I thought, well, she loves her job. We'll get her to stay. When I found out she was making, would make over $4 an hour more, plus full benefits at the state, unfortunately, we lost her to that job. More importantly, the people with disabilities she worked with, whose lives, health, and opportunities improved as a direct result of her work, lost her as well. As part of our ongoing effort to address the workforce crisis in our field, which I'm sure you're aware of, we eliminated three positions last year, non-direct care positions, to finance a 3% increase for our program staff only. For perspective, every 1% increase for our program staff costs about $30,000 annually for FAZE. The impact of the 7% cut to DWRS rates beginning 7/1 of 2018 is projected to cost us around $225,000 annually. Our state needs a disability waiver rate setting process that, one, improves the services to people accessing home and community-based services, and two, recognizes the incredible value of our program staff that provide today and those potential staff that will provide tomorrow key critical services day after day to Minnesotans with disabilities across every part of the state. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and you next. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Senator Abler and members of the committee. Thank you so much for this opportunity to let us talk with you today and to share our personal stories. My name is Cindy Ostrowski. I'm the CEO of Hiawatha Homes, a nonprofit located in Olmsted County. Hiawatha Homes was formed by a group of parents and community members. Hiawatha Homes currently supports over 120 individuals in our community, and we're known for our special support to people with high medical needs, some of whom needs 24-hour nursing support. We at Hiawatha Homes have been working diligently and relentlessly to provide a high level of individualized, person-centered quality care. Our team members are putting in numerous hours of overtime. They are cross-training at many homes, and they're filling as many open shifts as they can. But the reality of what is really happening and what will continue to escalate unless we all work together, unless we all implement this Best Life Alliance, Senate File 6, with an 8.35% competitive workforce factor, is a very scary and a very real reality. In 2018, as the CEO of Hiawatha Homes, for the first time in my 29 years of providing support and advocacy for people with disabilities, I was personally forced to make calls to five individuals' guardians to inform them that due to the severe staffing crisis at their loved one's home and the extreme situation that their loved one home was in, with several staff leaving to go to higher wage paying jobs, that we had no other choice but for the safety and the well-being of their loved one to close the Bearwood House and relocate their loved one to another Hiawatha home in the community. Five individuals left the house they called home and moved to a new location. This was a very emotionally and physically draining experience for everyone involved, including myself. Although we have taken many proactive measures to support the individuals and staff in our current high crisis staffing homes, and we have talked individually to family members and the individuals we support, the reality is our planning efforts may not be enough. And individuals have personally spoke to me, and they fear that their house may be next, that they may lose their home. We need to work together, we need to take action, and we need to address the significant wage gap between the direct support professionals and other similar professions, or matters will get progressively worse. Currently, the 7% cut to the individuals we personally support who have the on-bandit rates is over $106,000 annually. We are facing future 7% cuts for those we support who have the bandit rates will be over $627,000 annually. How can we continue to provide good quality care to those individuals we support? How will we continue to pay our staff a competitive wage? How will we be able to help the 15 people that are currently right now on our waiting list for residential services? And right now, we have 30 families and individuals waiting for in-home family support services and respite care services in Olmsted County. The reality is, we are currently supporting 10 fewer families than we did in 2014 through our family support services program. The reality is, we are now supporting 9 fewer people in our residential homes since 2014. And the reality is, we have 80 to 90 fewer staff than in 2014. This problem is growing. Our waiting lists are growing. Just since December 1st, our licensed social worker told me that she has had 16 people and families looking for services, and we can't help them. She has turned them away, and she's tried to help refer them to other services. But Hiawatha Homes cannot retain and hire new staff to meet their needs because we're currently trying to retain the staff that we have. Please help us value the lives of those we support. Please help us value the role and the responsibilities of our highly trained and highly skilled direct support professionals. We must take action to turn this trend around. It is all of our responsibilities to care for one another. We all need each other. Please support Senate File 6. Support the 8.35% competitive workforce factor so that we and all of our agencies supporting people with disabilities who are most vulnerable in Minnesota can better recruit and better retain our direct support professionals and team members. On behalf of all the individuals we support at Hiawatha Homes and our team members, thank you so very much for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Ostrowski. I have a question.
Yes.
Do you have beds that are open that you can't staff?
Yes, Senator Abler, currently the Bearwood House, I just signed papers on the closing this week, and the county informed us that those five beds were no longer part of Hiawatha Homes. Currently, we have four beds in our 21 homes, and we are not, although our waiting list is at 15, we're not accepting anyone at this time because of the staffing crisis. Our focus right now is providing quality services to those who we currently support. And so we could support more people, but we just can't retain our staff.
I get that. And Mr. Schmutzer, do you have vacant beds you can't staff?
Mr. Chair, we don't provide residential services. Oh. But we
do DKNH. You have day services.
Correct.
Stuff, right?
Okay. Mr. Chair.
And do you have openings you could accommodate that you can't staff?
We do, Mr. Chair, in two of our programs, yes.
Thank you very much. Mr. Goodnow, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I want to put some context around the bills that Senate File 6 and maybe some of the conversation. Won't dwell on the things that I know this committee has talked about in past years, but just want to update with regard to some new information and maybe put some context around some things that I think maybe we hadn't talked about before. As a very wise person who's testified to this committee said just a few moments ago, this is a complicated issue, and it's pretty hard to explain in this setting. But unlike him, we're going to try to do it here because I think this is the best place to try to accomplish that goal. One of the things that to keep in mind, the bill does basically two things that have a fiscal impact. One is it establishes a competitive workforce factor that Senator Uckey mentioned. The competitive workforce factor and the justification for that is based on analysis that the Department of Human Services has done. Last session, they did an informal analysis that showed there's about 11% difference in the rates between the comparable occupation and those that of the direct care workers. Since then, they did a more formal study, and that study showed that if you take the direct care workers out of the comparison group and just separate them as direct care workers versus the comparable occupations, the difference is actually 17.31%. The direct care workers on the low end of that. The bill has the competitive workforce factor set at 8.35, which in the system would restore the 7% that was reduced from that formula July 1st, 2018. So that's the justification for the 8.35. Now, some will say and some can argue that, hey, because the system is based on the base wage index, which is updated at regular intervals, that there really isn't a need for additional money in addition to that workforce that base wage index. That's okay if you just look at a system and if you assume the system when it started in 2014 was fully funded. But the reality is if you looked at the decade that preceded 2014, we had an inflationary rate, CPI, roughly in the 25% range over that 10-year period. And if you look at the rate increases that were given to these providers over that 10-year period, it was about 5%. So when the implementation of DWS took place, the assumption that was made in implementation was we weren't going to spend any more money when we implemented the new rate system than we would have spent under the old system. So there was an aggregate number that was arrived at, and the formulas were backed into in order to get to the number, so we spent that aggregate amount. We didn't spend any more based on that time. And so that's one thing I think that people need to keep in context as we're looking at this and then looking at the 7% and if it's justified or not. It's where are we at within the system, and we have a study that shows from DHS that we have a 17% differential in the wages that are being paid. The competitive workforce factor will address that. Additionally, there is the inflationary adjustment that's scheduled to take place every 5 years. Under this bill, it would take place every 2 years beginning after the next adjustment, which is scheduled for 2022. Mr. Chairman, I can talk about the differences between the Senate File 6 and the bill that was basically agreed to by the legislature last year, and or in comparison to your bill if you'd like, or I can just stand down at this point. And
I think we'll get to that. Maybe we'll just do some questions.
Okay.
Every time I listen to this, I get it figured out a little better. I don't want to sit in your chair. So your job is safe. The rebasing, the inflation that happens 2 or 5 years, is inflation on the old number, but not on the current number. So it's always going to lag. If we do this bill here, that'll cut that in about half, but it's always going to lag by that factor. Is that right, Mr. Goodnow?
Mr. Chairman, kind of.
In 100 years, will it catch up to the right price?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the base wage, and I'm sorry, when I started, I didn't introduce myself. Kevin Goodnow, and I'm here representing Moore and also the Best Life Alliance. The base wage index that was used and is used is the median number for the statewide median for that base wage index. So if it's a statewide median, there are half of them are above and half of them are below, but it's a statewide. And so that's one issue that some people will never catch up. The other cost factors are based off of what the study showed at that time. Now, on day services, based on the last DHS report, they showed that from the beginning of the rate system to where it's at today or close to it, there's a projected 5% increase in the rates and that's spent on day. Well, we've had an inflationary adjustment in that time period that was supposed to be over 11%. So on the day side, at least in the formula, something is missing. That it didn't recognize the full cost. And so this is complicated.
You're doing fine.
The base wage index has a number of component factors to the formula. And what we're concerned about is there may be some of those factors that don't fully recognize the costs that were in the system at the time or don't fully recognize the costs that should be recognized. And unless we adjust those factors, we may never do that. And so it's not just a matter of the inflationary adjustment, it's how that formula comes together and what components are either in it or not in it that could impact if it reflects reality or not.
But so the statewide median range wage business, it's not an absolute number you're trying to get to, it's the sum of these different factors based upon that. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's what I'm saying.
All right. And so the banding has protected some people, and that's scheduled to go off. And we don't know if it's going to last the 6 or 7 years. It seems like the odds makers are going with 6. But who knows? We don't know that, right, Mr. Goodnow?
Mr. Chairman, as of today, I don't believe we know. No, we do not know as of today. The impact on the banding, as far as the financial end goes, will be felt, I believe, in the 2021 biennium.
Okay. Let me ask my question another way, that earlier question. Let's say in those years we had 5%, not 25. Let's say you would have got 25% in those 10 years. Would eventually the number that we're going to, and assuming all other factors as correct or incorrect as they are, would we be at the same number? Would we be at a higher level now if we would have had that?
Mr. Chairman, in my opinion, based on the differential in the competitive workforce factor that study showed, is that if it had been 25% rather than 5% over that 10-year period, the likelihood of the base wage index being higher would have been likely that the base wage index would have been higher, and therefore the starting rate would have been higher.
But the increases might have been smaller because there was less ground to make up. Is that true?
What I'm getting at, and we'll see if it's, is that right now the competitive workforce factor, the differential based on the report is 17.31%. My guess would be is if we had been funded at a higher level over that decade leading up to the new system, that the differential would have been less. So let's just say the differential would have only been 7%. And so if the differential was 7%, then the base wage index, the data we were pulling from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, would have been higher. And so our base level where we start the formula would be higher.
Okay, and this base wage index is based upon this
data collected by the department. I'm sorry.
This cohort of workers, not like
Mr. Chairman,
clerical.
Correct.
Okay,
yep.
I got it. You know, I just got a little update from the TV people. We're losing ratings by the minute the more we go into this detail. But, it's really important.
Mr. Chairman, I don't doubt that for a minute.
Senator Benson. Anyway, we're going to do do you have any more testifiers?
No.
Okay, we're going to do like 10 more minutes on this, and then we'll let you, then we'll compare with the other bill. Go ahead, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Utke, this is heavy lift. There is a great memo that walks you through sort of the history. And we've been a little bit retrospective talking about, you know, we could have had 25% increase and we only got 5. What I want to know is with banding coming off, okay, I have a whole bunch of questions, but I'm only going to choose a couple.
Thank you.
Does this, if the money is funded the way your bill lays out, Senator Utke, does it go to the people who would have gotten the 7%, or are we giving it to a different population? So that's part one.
Let's do that question first.
And I do have a follow-up, so don't run too quickly.
I'll come back.
Okay.
We want to get our audience back and just answer single questions at a time. So, Senator Utke.
Yes, it does.
There. That was easy. You, Senator Benson.
Okay. And then part two, does the money that we're putting into the system help those people who are below banding come up or bring down the people who are above the banding? Does it help us get closer to unity? So if banding comes off, are we on a runway of getting people to fairness and equity? Because really the purpose of banding and the slap on the hand or smackdown from CMS was because there was so much disparity. Counties were negotiating rates all over the place, and they're compelling us to bring those into some uniform standard. Does this get us closer to a uniform standard, or are certain people more advantaged and exacerbating a problem that, you know, is not of our making and not anybody's fault?
Senator Utke or Mr. Goodnow, whichever.
I'm going to phone a friend.
Thanks.
So, Mr. Goodnow is going to take over.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Benson, the push from the CMS was because there was of the old system, which was county negotiated, and it was all over the place versus a uniform statewide methodology, which would be more along in a fairness where there would be a range of people that have similar needs would have similar rates associated with them. Banding was actually the transition from the old scattered system to the new system. So the 7% would bring everybody up who's in the system. So that it would go out and it would benefit the entire system. There wouldn't be winners or losers under that. However, if there are winners and losers, the 7% goes to all the providers. Some of them would see it immediately if they're unbanded, and more of them will see it after banding comes off.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, I thought the 7% only went to specific rates, providers.
Mr. Chairman, let me back up. So within the rate-setting methodology system that we're talking about applies to waivered services and the services that are provided under the three main disability waivers. So it's within that context that we're talking about those rates. The rates are set on an individual basis, so as an individual who receives the services, I have a rate that I carry with me when I go to a facility. So the rates aren't facility-based anymore, they're individually based. So within that population, there's about 36,000-plus people in that group. If they're all receiving services, some of them may have banded services where the rates are banded, and some of them may have unbanded services where the rates are unbanded. If they're unbanded, they will see an immediate benefit if this bill is implemented on July 1st because they'll have their rates restored at that point. The 7% will be restored. If they're unbanded, they'll see a benefit from it 6 months or 18 months later when banding comes off. And that's from the individual perspective. From a provider perspective, they're looking at the individuals that are coming to them for services. They're doing the calculation of figuring out where are their rates now, where are their rates going to be, and from a economic model, can I continue to do my operations the way I'm doing them based on what I'm expecting when banding comes off? So for some people, I know one provider in particular who's seeing somewhere in the neighborhood of a 20% reduction from the old rates to the new rates. The 7% helps mitigate the challenge they're going to face when banding comes off. But it is moving forward with that new system where everything's coming into that in line with the more with the fairness.
So, Senator Benson, if you had a high-rate place and this all moves in there, they're going to be the suffering a greater loss. If you had people that were living on shoestrings, they can buy new ones. So, Mr. Goodenough, if someone leaves a banded place and moves on their own, they become unbanded, right? They matriculate at the new place at the new rates. Is that right?
The person's banded.
Mr. Chairman, well, the person is banded, but they're banded as long as they're at an existing, receiving the services from the existing provider. That's with residential. With day, it's a different policy. So that's
okay.
Nothing's straightforward on this.
Why would it be? Thank you.
No, Senator Benson. Mr. Chair, and I know somebody's going to correct me if I'm wrong, so I'm not even going to say that, but I understood that individuals, depending on their needs, could have unbanded and banded rates.
Mr. Chairman, individuals.
People at home would be very confused if you say yes to that.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, if somebody's receiving residential services and day services, they could actually have some of their services banded and some of their services unbanded depending upon their circumstance. And in addition to that, when we talked about the people within the fairness scale, we also have, there is set aside money for people that to ask for exceptions. If they have extreme needs that aren't met by the formula, that they can ask to be, you know, given additional funds in order to be taken care of in a certain situation.
So, Mr. Chair, for the 36,000 individuals who receive services that would be impacted by this bill, will all of them see an increase, or will only some see an increase?
Mr. Goodenough.
Mr. Chairman, for the services that they're receiving that are under the framework, all those services would see an increase because all those services would have a competitive workforce adjustment to them. The end rate may not all go up at the same level. Some of them may go up below 7%, and some may be in excess of 7% because of the way the formula works. But in aggregate, the system gets another 7% back, but all of the services that are being paid for would see a 7% increase that are determined under the disability waiver rate system.
If it wasn't for computers, we wouldn't be in this situation with this very complicated thing. Can you imagine pen and paper running this thing? Never mind. Senator Benson, you can keep going if we have another couple minutes.
Mr. Chair, I think I just need to think for a little while. I know we're going to see this again, but I have spent more hours of my life on this than almost anything else. And I still do not understand if we're getting closer. Because at some point when banding ends, I have to kind of understand what that world looks like. And are we treating people fairly as we go there and mitigating pain for when that's going to happen? Or are we just sort of plugging in places for people who are, you know, have the ability to make noise and come here and ask for money? And so I'm trying to figure out. If we need some money in the system, then I want it to go in a fair way so that everybody who is having trouble finding care gets a little bump. And as we get closer to banding, we take off the cliff or remove the shock from the system.
Mr. Goodenough,
I'm trying to figure out how we do that.
Mr. Chairman, if I could try to answer.
Sure, this is a philosophical end of this bill. Here,
The major benefit, the bulk of the money that's spent for waivered services goes to residential, and they're well represented. The next largest group is day services. I think we're well represented, but we're only about 15% of the pie. There are smaller services out there that are independent unit-based services that aren't necessarily represented by the two trade associations and the providers that are in the audience. They would all benefit from this. They all benefit equally under this formula and this change. They're all treated the same.
Well, good. That's, I think, good enough for this bill. This bill is being laid over. Now, we've been talking about committee engrossments, and I just have a question for somebody. I'd like to request that this bill be engrossed into a committee engrossment and then posted somewhere. If I wanted to make that request of every bill that we act on that we leave laid over here, Do I need to ask per bill, or could I have a standing order for that a request? Mr. Monahan.
Mr. Chair, members, I think you could have a standing order for us to create the unofficial committee engrossment. Should you ever choose to act on a bill where you have already taken action on that bill, the first motion would be to adopt the unofficial committee engrossment for the purposes of the continuing work of the committee. And that motion would have to occur every time you take a bill off the table.
To move it, okay. And so, Mr. Monahan, if I could just create a standing order. And the point of that is some of these bills we're going to act on and then lay back on the table. Next bill is at an exact case in point. And so we want to make it possible for the people that are the public and us too can keep track of what on earth we've been doing. And I hope that's friendly to the public and the audience. So, Senator Uckey and to the testifiers, just so you know, this is Senate File 6. It's in our top 10, not by accident. Last year, we sent out $60 million or something trying to fix this. And I'm sorry that did not get across the finish line. But it's on our mind, and we are doing all we can do. So thank you for you and for those you represent. With that, Senate File 6.
Six.
I just said that.
Yeah.
I should remember that. It was laid over. And I've asked Senator Hoffman if he would present the next bill. So, Mr. Goodnow, please stay. And Senator Hoffman moves Senate File 92. And while he's coming, I'd like to point out the future of this particular bill. It's got a function in its own right, but in discussions with the, can I say House here? With the House.
You did.
Chairs, they are interested in doing some reforms of some sort, and if there's policy work related to PCAs and DWRS and that cluster of things, this bill would be the vehicle for that. And so we have our other bill, which is the Program Integrity and Fraud, which is House File 4, or Senate File 4, which is going to be integrity issues and that framework. This will be other things that are not related to fraud necessarily, just like streamlining or whatever we can kind of think of. And if there's some money, as you know, is going to be tight. But if we can make it easier so you have flexibility or something like that that makes sense, we want to continue to make the programs as streamlined as possible, but still as complicated as we could ever have, so we still need you all to come and tell us what on earth we're doing. So with that, Senator Hoffman moves Senate File 92 to be before us, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this goes way back. I think the only thing missing between you and I is Senator Rosen needs to be sitting in there taking back the years back in 2013 when we were in the room.
She missed your joke.
She missed my joke, but that's okay.
Senator Rosen, we were just harking back to a time when you sat between Senator Hoffman and I. It was actually Senator Hoffman and Representative Abler. You were sitting behind between us. And the therapy has not been helpful, apparently.
But I was traumatized. I would highly suggest not to ever do that again.
What dawned on that, Mr. Chair, was when Senator Benson was bringing up, we've been having this discussion with this system since 2013, and so here we are again at it. And I thought we had fixed this in 2014, but apparently we did not. But then again, so goes a veto. But Senator Abler, Mr. Chair, and members, the Senate File 92, really, when you look at it, it basically is the same. It's just a little scaled-down version of the last bill we just looked at. And there's two things to look at. In Section 4, the frequency of the updates on the base wage, we look at that, the system, from every 5 years to every 2 years, beginning July of 22. And then we're using the data not now, but rather it was 18 months prior to the schedule updates, rather than the most available data that's there. So it helps with that waging. It's a less onward cost, but it basically does the same thing. It establishes a new competitive workforce factor that goes into effect. Again, I think the dates are the same. We have to get federal approval on that, and that work factor goes at 4.55%, which results in a increase to the total rate for services that are reimbursed under DWRS. And unless I missed anything else, Senator Abel, I just wanted to point out, Mr. Monahan, this is the finest piece of memo I have ever seen explaining this DWRS system. And so Senator Benson had made it originally pointing that out, but this is really, this should be published. I think it's good for us. So with that, Senator Abler, Mr.
And
Goodnow.
Thanks, Senator Hoffman. And just to even summarize your summary, this would, if whatever that bill that we had that didn't get become law, that was the phone book, would have, this was the 4%, this was the July going forward.
Correct.
Part without the hold harmless. So, and Mr. Goodnow, you wanted to offer us some comparisons. This would be...
Mr. Chairman, I think between you and Senator Hoffman, you've done a fine job of doing that. I just want to make a note that there are two things in this, in Senate File 92, that help deal with the tails on the bill. One is that when you do the inflationary adjustment and you move it from every 5 years to every 2 years, as Senator Hoffman mentioned, you're looking 18 months back rather than at the most recent data. That should result in a savings in the fourth year of the biennium, and then also result in a savings on average over the subsequently into the bill, because that you're paying out the inflationary adjustments are in older data than they would have been under current law. The other thing that addresses that there's no increase in the competitive workforce factor under Senate File 92 in the future. The bill last year had a 1% percentage point adjustment in 2022. This one does not include that, nor does it include the automatic adjustment either.
Thank you. And does Senate File 6 have the future increase?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Senate File 6 does have an automatic increase that every time there's an inflationary adjustment, that the competitive workforce factor would be looked at, and that the analysis that DHS would do would have to be done again, and it would go up to that level, but not more than 2 percentage points at a time.
All right. Questions about this? Senator Hoffman,
we're good.
You have spent a good deal of time on this area and have a lot of expertise. So I'm actually glad you're helping me with this, because I'm seeing this as a bit of a partnership on with the particularly the policy reforms. And I just want to encourage people, we're kind of coming in for a landing here, but this has been a really good discussion, I think. And I think if nothing else, the public could be persuaded that we actually do dig in and we not only care, we actually try to, this on these complex matters, it really matters a lot. One-tenth of a something or other really can change a lot of lives. But so I would encourage those who are listening, if there's something you've been wishing you could do differently that just didn't make sense, they wouldn't let you do, now is a good time for that. If there's training requirements that make no sense and some you wish you could do instead, if there's, you know, we talk about the 4 beds to 5. I don't know what the perfect number is, but I don't think 4 is enough sometimes, especially when we can't serve people and there's waiting lists. And when that extra bed could serve a person just as well with no more staff, I think this is a time for that, because we must serve the people. And I asked each of the testifiers today if they had vacant beds they couldn't fill, the answer or slots, and the answer is yes, that's going to happen more and more. And so in our commitment to the people with the greatest needs, which is this population group, if we cannot serve them because we've made it too hard, that is really going to be a problem. And so you have the commitment from me, and I know the committee as a whole, we all care about this a lot. And so with that, I will lay the bill over for future work. And Monday is a holiday. If you want to come here to enjoy a meeting, bring your friends on Monday and enjoy the meeting. But we will not be here, so we'll be back Wednesday. And thanks to all the members and the public for all their work and the great testifiers. We're adjourned.